selection process. And he's got a presentation and he's going to cover the details of the BAPCA, which is the Analysis of Brownfield Cleanup Alternatives. This is the report that EPA requires to document what we're going to do with the material. And John will get into the details of the material. But in general, there's some stuff that's not too bad, and there's some stuff that's bad. The stuff that's bad is going to Arlington. The stuff that's not too bad, we're proposing to place locally. So we'll get into those details. And then at the end, John can answer any questions specifically about this process. Rebecca Alberwells is here from DEQ to answer any questions about the solid waste permit that we just got done finishing together and submitting, and it's in this final review process. Mm-hmm. And then if there's any questions about the future of the square, we ask Brett to attend to answer those questions. Okay, I'll let John start with the presentation.
Is this my clicker thingy? Or?
Sorry about
that. All right. See if I can operate this.
Let's see if it's going to work.
This has got a light on.
It's got a light on.
What am I pointing at? That would be the question. Or I could stand over there and I could hit.
I can do that.
Left and right. Left and right. Okay, thank you. All right, thanks, Brett. Thanks, Jeff. So, again, my name is John Kiefer. I'm with AMEC. Foster Wheeler, and so I'm going to talk about the cleanup process, which is the stage of the game that we're at here now. So to recap on this EPA grant that the city's received, it's a $400,000 grant that's split between assessment of the contaminants and then actual cleanup. And whereas most EPA grants fund either assessment or cleanup, this one is a pilot grant and it actually funded both. So it's a rare type of grant, highly competitive, sought after. So the process of the grant starts with the site assessment on the top there. And the site assessment includes what we call a phase two environmental site assessment. And that's collection of soil samples, collection of groundwater samples, and analyzing them. And then once that's all done, you move into the cleanup planning phase, which is where we're at right now, the cleanup planning. And then finally, the last step, which is the cleanup, and that's where we expect to be in a few weeks. So for the site here, we have back in 2014 was when the first sampling was done, and then again recently, a couple months ago. But for the 2014, there was three main areas of the site, here, here, and here, where we collected soil and groundwater samples, a total of 13 soil samples, another 10 groundwater samples, and then the stockpile soils, like you've seen in the former Safeway basement, we actually did about 10, 12 samples from each of those, which were composited together into a collective sample. So that was the 2014 sampling. Based on the 2014 sampling, it was determined that we needed to do some follow-up sampling this year. And so we put together a work plan that Rebecca and DEQ reviewed, but really these areas here in red and down around here were areas that we did some follow-up sampling. So the Safeway stockpiles, which everyone's pretty familiar with, and then actually underneath the parking deck out there, there's some piles of soil, and so that was also sampled, and that would have been like this area up here, and then just some more random sampling underneath the parking deck. So the sampling plan was approved at the end of June. We did the actual sampling on July 21st and 22nd of this year, collected about 30 to 40 soil samples. And no groundwater samples this time, just soil samples. And we tested them for a whole slew of different contaminants that DEQ, EPA are concerned about, and these would include total petroleum hydrocarbons, what we call polynuclear aromatic hydrocarbons, your volatile organic compounds, these are things that have been volatilized, metals, PCBs, and then we also tested for some physical parameters just to see how suitable the material was to be used for fill. So looking at organic content, grain size, you know, how much sand versus clay, that sort of thing. And one nice thing was that EPA provided their Region 10 laboratory in Manchester, Washington, for running these samples, so there was no charge to the city for the samples. So the areas that we sampled this latest round, again, the Safeway stockpiles, just a shot of those, photo of those. And then this would be the larger stockpile, the smaller one, and then we went underneath the parking deck and did sampling of the soils that are a little bit different that are sitting under the parking deck. The results, the site assessment is now complete, so we're done. And the results are basically similar to what we had found before. So no surprises. What we still see is widespread, low-level type impact to soil from petroleum, polynuclear aromatic hydrocarbons, PCBs, and metals. So just kind of spread out, but low-level impact. The stockpiled soil in the former Safeway basement, it's not ideal for use on site, so it's got to go. The stockpiled soil underneath the parking deck is a little bit hotter, as Jeff alluded to. That stuff's got some lead in it. It looks different than the Safeway stockpile soil, and it is different. It's more contaminated. And we didn't find any volatile organic compounds in the soil to speak of. Groundwater, there's some low-level solvents in the groundwater beneath the Heritage Square site and Duane Street. The concentrations are really only of concern if the groundwater moves and carries them to the Columbia River. The fact that we didn't really find anything in the soil tells me that there's probably not a lot of a source around there, and we'd probably expect it to decline over time. The important point to leave you with here is that the concentrations that have been detected are nothing that folks should be alarmed about. It's nothing that's really going to pose a risk to how the site would be developed, whether it be urban residential or occupational park use, as long as there's not sort of basement occupants, and that's something that we're working with DEQ on. Yeah.
To clarify, you could go up, you just don't want us to go down.
But there's, at this point, but there's ways to also manage, if there is a desire to go down, there's ways to manage that.
Okay.
Yeah.
So like a basement slab?
Yeah.
In the end, cabin.
Good question. So now we're at the cleanup planning stage, and so the analysis of brownfield cleanup alternatives, or APCA for short, is the report that Jeff was showing. It's available for public review. I just entered a copy at the library and one here. And it also includes the results of the recent sampling. So basically includes a summary of everything that's been done to date. And what the document... Go ahead.
It's also on the website.
And it's on the website. Okay, good. So easy to take a look at it. It's, I don't know, it's 30 pages long, maybe. And really what it does is it looks at... There's only a handful of technically feasible cleanup options. And so what the document does is it looks at those options and really ranks them against one another based on how effective they are, if they're... reliable in the long term, how implementable they are, is there a risk associated with the implementation, how sustainable is it, what's the cost associated with it, and we even look at things like, on the sustainability side, like if sea level were to rise a little bit, would that affect things? So, So we look at a lot of different things, yeah.
And greenhouse gas emissions for trucks hauling.
Correct, yes. So that which falls, yeah, into the sustainability. So we look at a plethora of things to figure out which is the best option. And the preferred alternatives are then identified in the document. So for this document here, this app, we've got preferred alternatives for soil and preferred alternatives for groundwater. For soil, what the preferred alternative is to remove the stockpiles of soil, excavate, all under the parking deck here. So the stockpiles in the former Safeway, those would go. The stockpile underneath the parking deck would go, and then some of this area around here, there'd be some excavation of soil down to about 12 inches, or basically down to the water table, to get some of that out. And for the Safeway stockpile soil, there's a reuse option. Go ahead, yes.
This year's testing said there wasn't a risk of the soil, but you're referring to the 2014 samples that have to be removed? You're saying some of the soil has to be removed, but you're saying the 2015 sampling indicated that there was no problem with building over the existing soils. Or maybe I'm misunderstanding something.
It's the data is basically the same. The 15 data and the 14 data basically said the same thing. So there's low-level impacts. It's some of the material that's underneath the parking deck is...
John, let me get to clarify. I think Council Pershing's question is, the statement earlier said that there's no problem with redeveloping the site, but that's assuming the soils were removed, correct?
Removed or kept.
Okay.
Yes.
You didn't okay. Put that in your slide. So.
And I think the other point that you're talking about, correct me if I'm wrong, is we said that the soil wasn't suitable for reuse on site. That's because of the design structural considerations. Mm-hmm. That's why it's not suitable. It's not necessarily it's not suitable chemically.
Right.
It's not suitable for...
Exactly. Well, that's why they moved it from the garden because it wasn't suitable.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right.
I think in future public presentations, you might want to add that extra information saying it's suitable, but the earlier, that the contamination is not problematic if you do selective removal, and then it's not suitable for reuse because of compaction issues rather than contamination issues, if I'm understanding.
Yeah, good point.
Thanks.
So the local reuse option for the Safeway stockpile soils would be for the... city-owned portion of the quarry, which Jeff can talk about more. Some of the stuff, the stockpiles, the smaller stockpiles under the parking deck that we mentioned have the higher concentrations of contaminants. They've got lead. That stuff's going to go to Arlington Landfill. I'll show up a slide of where that's located. And then there may be some soils underneath the parking deck once we're done pulling things out that still exceed some of the cleanup levels, and those might need to have a protective cap installed. Does that make sense?
Getting closer.
Okay.
Getting closer. So you won't really know until you remove the contaminated soil if you have to further remove contaminated soil. Okay.
Or if we need to cap something.
Okay.
We'll probably, we know where it is, we'll get what we can. It may be that some little bits just have to be left behind due to constraints,
right.
And those will be capped.
Great, thanks.
Yes, sir.
Well, when you did the soil sampling, did you core all the way down to the water table in each case?
Yes.
And so what depth range were you looking at?
Underneath the parking deck, the water table is only this deep below the soil. So we basically sampled at what? The surface and 6 inches
and a
foot.
16 inches below, not ground surface, but 16 inches below the walkable surface underneath the parking structure is where it starts getting wet. And this was under a pretty dry time of year. We had a really dry spring. And so sampling in July, you're finding wet soil about 16 inches below that. And so that's why we're wanting to do a removal as soon as possible before the water table rises with the rain. But it's pretty shallow.
But you must have a pretty... When you When you did your soil samples, did you composite the full depth, or did you do in depth?
I think they were depth discrete. I believe.
So you must have a pretty good idea whether the soil below.
We think it's pretty clean when it gets down about 12 inches. Yes. So.
Just the proofing of it, make sure.
Yes. So we'll see what for sure is left behind. Which makes sense, because I think where the water table is probably getting close to maybe some of the original ground surface, which you really wouldn't expect to be contaminated. It's sort of the stuff that was dumped in there since that there's more chance to have some petroleum and whatnot associated with it. Groundwater, it's the preferred alternative is basically going to be some monitoring and what we call institutional engineering control. So you wouldn't be able to consume the groundwater. You wouldn't be able to put a well there and pull the water out and use it for drinking water or industrial use. It needs to stay there. But some monitoring of it, a couple of additional monitoring events. So we put in a monitoring well and tested a couple of times, make sure the concentrations are staying the same or slowly declining so that we know that there isn't a problem that's going to stick around for a significant length of time. I mentioned the groundwater would be extracted for use. The fact that, I mentioned that we don't really see a source in the soils means there's probably not a large source. There must be a little one somewhere, or we wouldn't have something in the groundwater. But it can kind of be like trying to find a needle in a haystack to when you have a low levels of contaminants in groundwater, especially VOCs or volatile compounds. It can be very hard to find the source in soil.
There was a previous question a while ago about the contamination in this corner and how it maybe came from an oil tank at the senior center or something, but could you just talk a little bit with our groundwater regime and how much water moves? I mean, some of this could be from businesses a block or two up.
Correct. Low, yeah.
From a long time ago.
Yeah, especially when you have low levels of what we call chlorinated solvents, they don't move in a consistent, predictable pattern all of the time. They can be little stringers, and sometimes you'll see them, sometimes you won't, and so they are harder to interpret. The levels here again are pretty low. They're a little bit above what is allowable to reach the Columbia River, and so that's the issue we need to go. Yes, please.
The other interesting thing about the site is that the historic tide line pretty much cuts through the site right in half. So that also speaks to the sort of sloshing around the groundwater that we're seeing this detection of chlorinated solvents. So it just adds complexity to, the question, but what we're trying to do with the removal is to remove, if you think of a source, you've got a pile of something, if you remove as much as possible that potential source, you're decreasing the ability for that source to continue to contribute whatever contaminant you're looking for in groundwater. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm.
And then being that we have a lot of dredge spoils too. From dredge spoils.
Yeah. Like, who knows? Yes.
Do you have any idea how far toward the river it has moved? Detectable concentrations of either metals or something else? Can you say?
We've only tested on the site in Duane Street. So that's as far as we have data.
And we've thought about going towards the river, but there are a lot of things that could cause some uncertainty the closer we get to the river, businesses, historic, other cleanup sites. So if we find something, if we hop another block over, is it from this site? Is it from another site? How do we
I'd be interested to know, not just trying to point a finger at who put it there, but just how concentrated is the stuff and how close is it seeping into the river?
It's low level, so it's a level that there's been some modeling that's been performed, and this is available on the website, where some very conservative values are put into a model. And so let's say this is the worst case concentration. and we're going to say that everything between this site and the river is sand, which means things move really quickly and really easily through them. That's not necessarily the case, but we're going to worst-case scenario it. And in that in that situation, then that contamination reaches the river. That's very unlikely. Do we have points to prove that wrong? No. But given the age of the source, so we know that for a number of years, nothing has happened on the site where there's a new source of contamination. There hasn't been a dry cleaner like there was. There's not a print shop like there was. There's not an automobile repair shop like there was. There are all these three things. Those are like the three worst things you can have on a property, basically, for cleanup. So we've looked at different scenarios, and again, given the uncertainty of not knowing exactly what that concentration is, even at the worst case scenario, if we're removing what we call source mass, we're removing the ability for this material to continue to migrate to the river.
And if it is coming from somewhere up here, the concentration might go up in 10 years as that migrates down here, or same thing with that.
Potentially, but there's...
Like oil tanks.
Well, but if it was an oil tank, we wouldn't... So what we're seeing is something called vinyl chloride, and I think PCE.
Yeah.
Which... TCE is something that it's in solvents. You can buy it right now to degreaser. It's a degreaser. So these materials are still around. You can still use.
Well, is there an indication the stuff is breaking down in the soil by
the fact that there's vinyl chloride in the groundwater concentrations shows us that there's breakdown happening, which is a good thing. Because this is how the chemical makeup of this contaminant that was likely associated with a dry cleaner, it breaks its last chemical structure before it goes to something that's totally benign as vinyl chloride. So it's a good thing.
Anything you can inject in there to get those little bugs to work faster?
You could.
Ma'am.
But that has its own complications associated with it, too. And when we look at... John had a slide of the balancing factors. You know, implementability, effectiveness is a key one here. Cost. Given that low concentration, is it really going to make a big difference if we were to look at that? And how effective would it be? We don't know. I mean, it's... So we have to look at those balancing factors to see what's going to make sense.
So you could... I mean... One thing you could inject air into the water and you could volatilize the stuff out, but that would be an intensive remediation system, which would have a significant cost, and it might clean up a little bit faster than it does naturally.
I would propose something like that, but biological things have a lot of possibilities of getting them started in there and to put the right suite of bugs in there for the chemicals.
And there's probably what we call dehalogen. You remember the name of the bugs, bacteria.
Something called
Concordes or something. But there's actually, documented, species of bacteria or genuses of bacteria that will break down the chlorinated hydrocarbons. They're probably present already, would be my guess when you look at the what we call the daughter products. So you have the perchloroethylene, which has four chlorines, and then you've got the tri, which is three, the di, which is two, and the vinyl chloride, which is one. So we've gotten it from four down to one. Something's doing that. Mm-hmm. So.
Questions?
Yeah, good questions. So here's the local... reuse disposal option. Again, there's the poster here. It's maybe a little bit more visible. This is where it would be right here on the back end of the former quarry, sort of where this dirt here is being put already, about 10 foot back from the salt cliff there. So we'd be coming out this way. And so it's got a lot of fill material beneath it. It would have a lot more placed above it, so it would kind of be put in a sandwich. So there's really no way anybody could possibly come into contact with this stuff. And it's not seriously bad anyway, but it's a pretty safe really an ideal solution for this material.
What are the dimensions of the yellow box at roughly?
So, so what we calculated, I mean, we came up first with the thickness. You know, five foot thickness is what we determined would be a good place to start. And then worked in, like he was talking about, John was talking about the setback from the property line. So this is a private property, this is our property all around it. 10 foot on both sides, and then 162 was the length that it just came out to be, to get that volume. So the idea is that as the quarry's being, you know, reclaimed and filled back in, the ultimate goal is to get the soil probably 30 feet above where we're going to be, maybe up to 60, depending on where you're at exactly, but against this slope so there's not rock fall issues, things like that. This is private property, not in our control. This is, and this will be used for a lay-down area for tree management during storms, things like that.
Where's that fill there from? Where is that all from?
Oh, all this here? Uh-huh. This is, so what's happening here is this is owned by Jim Nikas, who is affiliated with Big River. And so they've been using that. That's actually our CSL material.
It's your boy.
But then from the CSL project, 63.
Oh, okay. Right. Super overflow
pattern. Does that get tested
at all? It's been tested. I mean, it gets inspected archaeologically, but...
I'm sorry?
I mean, we've been doing archaeological investigation on it for requirements, but no, material testing, it's just dirty. I mean, if they find anything, we shut the job down, and anything discolored or even odor or anything. Yes.
Will there be anything on top of it to kind of cap it or seal it in place?
So what we're going to do is when this material goes in 5 foot thick, and what they'll probably do is knock this back down to about this ground level. This level you see right there is this flat ground here. Put that material in, and then we're going to survey it with our GPS unit, so it's in our GIS system, so we can always track it. Then they're going to put a fabric on top of it as a demarcation, so if anybody ever happened to dig there, which, like I said, is going to be really hard because it's not too deep. But just say they kept reclaiming and decided to stop at some point, or they shaped it differently. We didn't get that much fill. We have a requirement to get 3 over the top of it now, so we'll put the fabric, 3 foot of soil. But if anybody ever dug down, they would hit that fabric and know that they're there. Just like we do on utilities, we put tape.
And
sometimes
the fabric and then the 3 feet of soil, that's safe for recreational users. I just know people hike back there. I see bike tracks sometimes.
It's absolutely safe.
So it's going to be 3 feet, but then I think, and Jeff, correct me if I'm wrong, eventually it's going to be even with that wall. So it's going to be eventually under 3 feet.
Well, at least sloped up too. Yeah. So that wall needs to be there.
So 3 feet will be the bare minimum, and it's just going to grow from there. Yeah.
Is there any way we can put some, like, testing sites on the downslope of this to see, you know, just to track it for a year or two or three to see if there is any groundwater seep drift? Like, I've been assured it's very unlikely, but I would really like to make sure that we monitor it for a while after we put it in.
Well, we do have, I think putting monitoring equipment, you know, directly below it would be kind of tricky because I don't know what depth, but down below, keep in mind, down below this, at the landfill, we have an extensive groundwater monitoring system, the leachant, and even in gas and everything else. So anything shows up irregular there, this would be the first place to look. But once again, I mean, you compare this to that, it's, I don't know how you compare it, but it's...
I can tell you, you wouldn't find anything. You know, if you were to put wells there, you know, even if something was to leach, which there's no reason to suspect that, even if there's something would, it's something that you would maybe see show up 25 years from now. So, I mean, you wouldn't see
in very low concentration.
Yeah.
And the contaminants that we're talking about moving up to that site are contaminants that don't like to be mobile.
Yes.
So there are things like metals and PAHs, which they like to cling to soil particles and just stay there. Mm-hmm. Whereas with the volatile contaminants that we're seeing in groundwater here at the site, those like to be mobile. Mm-hmm. But thankfully, we're not seeing those in the soil here.
What's a pH of the water that's kind of filtered up there? It can mobilize as well.
the pH of the water that's going
to... That will infiltrate. In other words, when rainfall lands on the surface around here and it goes into the shallow soil, what would be a typical pH?
Our rainfall here is acidic.
Well, it's always a little bit.
Yeah, 6.2 or something?
But there's also going to be drainage enhancements around there, isn't that right?
Yeah, it's between 6 and 7, because so 7's neutral, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I went to the Oregon State soil testing thing, and they said it's acidic enough where that's why things don't grow here, maybe add a lot of lime. Around that, maybe 6.4, I don't remember what they said, but it was
super acidic. But yeah, you get your carbonic acid too from the leaf litter and stuff when the rain goes through. One of the reasons we're back 10 feet from the basalt face here is because surface runoff along the hill will not intersect the stuff we're putting there. So it's as Rebecca was mentioning, and Jeff, it's going to be somewhat isolated, so you really are only looking at the actual rainfall. I would not expect any mobilization of any metals whatsoever. So the stuff that's really high for metals is what's going to Arlington. So.
Any more questions on that site?
Okay, so the more interesting material, is what we'll call it, is basically going to go all the way out to almost, you know, halfway across the state to Arlington. So it's past the Dalles. Someone mentioned that was talking about the Dalles. So here's the Dalles. You can't really see it from where you are very much, but so Astoria, Portland, the Dalles, and then another hour or so out in the desert is a hazardous waste landfill, and that's where you send all of the nasty stuff in the state. And so it's not a lot. It's about 50 or 60 cubic yards of material underneath the parking deck, but that's where that'll go.
It's about 6 truckloads.
Yeah, right. Yes, yes.
It seemed like we were here in Beaverton Hillsboro initially.
That was not for the hot stuff. That was for the Safeway stockpiles, which we didn't know. We hadn't done all this follow-up testing, which we now have done, which shows it's fine to go to the local option. It doesn't have to go to Hillsboro, which would be not sustainable and very expensive.
Oh, so. Okay. So we've eliminated that mid-range. We're just kidding. Keeping it local or sending it to Arlington?
Yeah, I believe so. Everything, yes. Yeah.
And Rebecca, you had calculations on the carbon emissions that are being saved.
They're in the app. John put together a really interesting table, how many pounds of CO2 would be emitted if all of this material had to go to Hillsboro. It's significant. And the other thing to look at is, or consider with this, is the amount of grant funds that are being used to haul the material to Hillsboro. You're essentially paying someone in a truck to drive the truck full of soil that's marginally contaminated to Hillsboro.
With pollution up.
So again, it's a balancing factor. You know, how we're trying to achieve, you know, a green cleanup, both green environmentally but also financially. And so this option of disposing the material locally pencils out in many ways. And it's protected. That's the key thing. It's the first thing we look at is this safe? Are we, you know, controlling risk associated with contacting this material? That's why we're moving it. We don't want people or critters to come into contact with this material, so how do we manage it safely? And this was a really good option.
But yeah, you bring up the good point. You basically would be doing more environmental damage to the truck than you would be saving. So final slide here is just sort of post cleanup here and looking at a few months down the road. You know, and what's anticipated, you know, we're not anticipating restriction on what can be done with the site. We're anticipating that, you know, the full range of options remain, you know, residential, park, commercial. The one limitation, you know, may be residential beneath street level. That may be off the table, but everything else should be fine. DEQ, and Rebecca can speak to this. It's likely to require a ground water use restriction. This was mentioned earlier that you can't pull water out of the ground because we're not looking at trying to clean up all of the groundwater. There are low levels there of the volatiles. The contaminated media management plan, it's a short, simple document that basically just says 5 years from now if someone's digging on the site, if there's certain areas that we had to leave something, you know, in place that was, you know, covered by a protective cap, it just alerts future construction project workers as to, you know, what to do, how to manage stuff if they end up digging deep, what they need to do with it. The no further action is very achievable here. The timing of delivery is a little bit uncertain. We'll know more once this cleanup is done and we've seen what was left in place, what had to be left in place beneath the parking deck. And I don't know if you want to add anything to that, Rebecca.
But I'm kind of interested in maybe talk about that. And then there's, you know, some planning activities which are going on this fall about what could happen there. There's been the idea of housing component. There's the discussion of could there be a library, so on and so forth. What are the factors? I mean, I know it's not, you can't say, oh, it would be something to be issued in 6 months, but what are the variables that you're looking at for issuance of that?
Sure. So what we've been trying to, and what we talked about through the whole process, is trying to get the site to the highest end use possible. So whether that is residential, I mean, it'd be great if this is, the removal's done, we take our confirmation samples after, so what we're calling like leaf surface confirmation samples. If we meet residential, what we call risk-based concentrations, which are essentially screening levels that are protective of human health, that's great, because that means no restrictions. But we don't know. You know, we're gonna dig out as much as we can, and we're gonna take samples. But the data may tell us, okay, we meet these levels, but we don't meet those levels. That still doesn't restrict the type of use that the site could be. It just means that the site needs to be managed to be protective. So it could mean having to install a cap. So typically that looks like, in situations like this, like a concrete or some sort of barrier. Essentially, we don't want people to eat dirt. And you can eat dirt very easily. You know, there's dust and it can land on your desk and, you know, on your coffee cup or whatever. So we would look for ways to manage that risk. So we're not here to say, okay, you cannot put a library there or you cannot put a condo. We're here to say, okay, how can we do this safely and what needs to be installed or implemented to make this a safe use. Does that help?
If you want, like, say you went with a multi-story structure,
right,
and you developed it into a building like that and you wanted to put utilities down below or something like that, you're going to have a concrete slab anyways. You're not going to put those on dirt. And that would not satisfy you.
And we would look at, I mean, we get it. You know, there's utilities that need to run through there. So that material just needs to be managed. And there's also this contaminated media management plan also speaks to how to properly dispose of that material. Because we're also kind of looking out for liability issues with the city. So we don't want this material just going anywhere. You know, we want it to be managed properly. So if there is some sort of utility conduit or some, you know, an additional removal needs to occur to build out whatever phase of the development needs to happen, this contaminated media management plan will provide certainty to a developer or a construction. It's basically a recipe. Okay, I'm running into this area. Where do I do? Okay, put that over there. And that's how it needs to be disposed of. So it's really good. I mean, there's front-end work associated with it, but it actually saves time in the long run because, you know, being around construction projects, you don't want people leaning on shovels or leaning up against a bulldozer. You want to work. And so this contaminated media management plan helps to speak to the uncertainty associated with, you know, development. Does that help?
I know we have some folks who are a part of subcommittees that are working on developing the plan, and also we have city councilors here who are interested in this. I just want to be able to have that conversation so people can hear what factors.
numbers.
Yeah.
We'll need to
reapply. Don't let this affect your vision, because I've seen many really cool renderings of what that site can be, and that park is amazing. And so don't let this cloud that. We can manage site risk. We might need to change some things. It might look a little different, but don't let this dictate what your vision of what your downtown area looks like.
But it could add costs.
It definitely could, but we're not inventing the wheel. People have done this. It's totally doable. They've done it in a protective manner as possible. And this is not unique to Astoria. This is happening in communities all over the place, because this is the legacy of,
Yeah, I know. But I think what Brett's getting at is they're trying to plan on it, and cost is a big factor. So it's going to be hard to know until we get down there and see what's left, if it's totally clean.
One good point on the excavations down below is that, like you mentioned, the groundwater's right there. If you start excavating through that groundwater, your dewatering and copper dams, everything you do are going to be 100 times the cost of taking the soil of Hillsborough. Mm-hmm. So that's not a factor that's going to be comparable.
But it seems like for people to understand what a given choice of project out there might ultimately cost, they are going to have to wait a little longer, really, if they want the certainty.
It depends. So if the subgrade, so as John mentioned, everything at ground surface, is the site is protective. Mm-hmm. It's protected as it is right now. So it depends on what's the vision, what's the plan for below the parking structure. That's what we're talking about. And it's not a huge piece of the property, actually. There's one section. There's the Safeway piece. That looks good. I mean, that soil has been on concrete this entire time. So we're okay there. Gardner Surgeon Ways is done. So, what does it look like underneath the parking structure? And there have been some communities, like Hillsborough, who have part of their vision for what their site looked like involved additional removal of contaminated soil. They basically moved a parking garage. They reconfigured it to take care of residual contamination. Like, oh, we need parking, so let's just put the ramp over here. We needed to excavate a little bit more over there, so we're good. As far as dewatering areas in Southwest Portland, they've looked into that. It's an issue, so they've just created what we call what's the technical term for it? Hardscape. It means concrete. It means no one's going to dig through it. A dog's not going to be able to dig through it and come into your house or lick its paws and get sick. So, again, it's manageable.
It's not going to be cost effective to build 3 floors down.
Oh, so I know that. Yes.
For water table.
That's suggested.
It's a shallow water table. Yeah.
Rebecca, do we John, do we know what's under the concrete there in the Safeway Hall?
There's been some samples beneath there, and there's nothing that's indicating it's an issue right now. But that contaminated DNA management plan will help speak to that, too. So if there's any surprise if that slab gets broken up, that contaminated media management plan, CMMP, is the recipe for dealing with that material.
And does the grant cover the final samples and the CMMP, or will that be later?
I think it depends on what final contractor costs are as to how much there is. I mean, I think everything that needs to be done to get to the NFA is not going to fit entirely within the grant as it is, and we still have to see exactly what the subcontractor bids are.
And we have a match to our grant, so we're not backing that. That's
so, timeline. Can you talk about that? I mean, we're doing a presentation today. What are we looking at in terms of being able to move forward with removing some soil?
So this public comment period ends November 3rd?
Yes.
I think. And that's a required 30-day public comment period for EPA. So my understanding is, like, there's some actions happening to get folks ready, provided. So there's a reason why we're having this meeting, though. We want feedback, what do you think about this plan? This is going to happen. We need to hear back. What do you think? Do you have any concerns? Do you have any additional questions? So assuming there's no significant change in what's being proposed, which is the removal of this material, some of it going up to the quarry, some of it going to Arlington,
Then we're working on what's called an interim remedial action measures work plan, which is probably 75% complete, and once this public comment period is done, it'll probably take us a week to wrap that up to send to, I guess, you and Brandon to take a look at, and then assuming a couple of weeks, we would hope to be moving dirt, say mid-November would be our hope. Contractor schedule permitting.
Does weather matter if it's pouring down rain?
Pouring down rain is not ideal, and totally dry, dusty is not ideal. So the ideal would be little rain showers here and there to keep the dust down. Would be
El Nino here be perfect?
It would be. There you go.
November is the rainiest month of the year here in Astoria.
It is. Yeah.
Very simple.
So yeah. We got a drought forecast in December.
Yeah.
If we could have had this all done before Halloween, I mean, we certainly would have. That's you know, I grew up in Coos Bay. I know what happens Halloween. You know, it's could get soaked or not. You know, but that's kind of when things start to switch over typically. Brent, you were kind of trying to figure out when the NFA might be arriving too, right? So that was the other part, and so I think that is, you know, for groundwater, is it, you know, one dry season, one wet season? You know, I think it's what shows a conclusive trend, I think, is really the question there.
That, and you know, what do the confirmation samples tell us? You know, so it really is an if then statement, you know, or an answer. So if we, there's obviously access issues, particularly beneath the parking structure. You know, how much of that material can be removed, given the limitations of, you know, there's some really great ideas as far as how to get in there and really, you know, get this stuff out of there. But at the end of the process, how much material can actually be removed? So we'll be looking at that. We're going to be looking at confirmation samples, what those concentrations tell us, and also what's going to make sense from a groundwater perspective. Do we have a good evaluation of groundwater at different times of year? So we could be looking at one sampling event maybe in the winter and then one in the lower time of year. Maybe we already have that sort of low groundwater table. We just need to look at it and see if in the meantime, if there's a developer or someone who's interested in the property, we've done this before. Dean, you can provide what we call a comfort letter saying, look, everything the city has done, everything that we've asked them to do, you know, the site risk is this. I mean, hopefully there won't be any, you know, residual site risk, but maybe there will be. But this is how we plan on managing it. So there's tools that we can help out with if there is someone who's interested or if it's holding up the project. We certainly don't want to do that. Brownfields are all about getting sites cleaned up and reused, and we don't want to be in that. So however we can help kind of navigate that for the city, we're happy to do that. I wish I could give you a date.
I think this is just all good information for everyone to kind of hear, time-wise.
If you find that the groundwater is still contaminated to some extent, how will you define how large an area will be restricted from using that groundwater?
It would be confined to the site.
Just to the site.
Right. That's where the source would be. Well, then we have other issues.
Across the street and drink it a well and give it to children.
Well, we don't own, you know, the city doesn't own all of the property between, and it's actually.
No, but I mean, if you find that groundwater is contaminated, wouldn't you want to identify that so people don't consume it?
Well, right now the concentrations are really low. The only thing that's exceeding is for critters out in the river.
I know. I'm just looking at Y902 up there, and I was just wondering if that happened, how would you go about determining it? And you're telling me it would just be beneath the site itself.
Well,
it's a very good question you bring up, and it's not just here. I mean, I can think about, you know, every site I've ever worked
right.
on, it's
exactly.
the same thing, because
exactly.
if anyone wants to put in a well, they don't go to DEQ. The Water Resources Department needs to
sign off on it. They don't know there's a contaminated site next door. So I think that it is a legitimate question. And if someone thought there was a real issue and you got wind of someone doing something, then you'd want to step in. But here, like Rebecca says, the concentrations are really low. We don't think someone's getting ready to put in a massive production well that's going to suck thousands of gallons a minute across the street. But, yeah, you bring a fair point.
Yeah, I'm just wondering what would be the process for that being learned by the person.
Hopefully they would be hiring
For a permit for a well drilling, does it look at some database that says, hey, wait a minute, you're right near, you know, there's a jillion gas tanks, for example, that have leaked. It seems like there would be a database.
There are databases, and this site is on one. So hopefully they would hire someone to look at databases before they sunk the well and put all the money into putting in a well.
And my understanding is that Oregon Water Resources, when they get what's called a STAR card, they do look at those databases.
Okay. I would hope so.
But that's, you know, like John said, you bring up a good point. There is no, like, catch-all. But typically in, you know, I don't know if we would consider this like an urbanized area, but it's certainly not, you know, forest, open land. That question would certainly come up.
Yeah, the well issue is much more applicable in places where they don't have domestic water supply.
Right.
Mm-hmm. With our water supply, who's going to go spend $20,000 to build a well when they can pay one of the lowest
rates in the state? They might want a special kind of water for beer making or distillery. They didn't. So.
That was, I think, the last slide I had, so I think we are really in the Q&A part right now.
All right. Any questions?
We have so many during.
No, having a group like this makes it easy to be able to dialogue throughout the meeting. So it's
exactly. Yeah. That's the best way to do it anyways, but then you're not trying to remember and you're dealing with it at the time. How about who raise your hands if you're on the committee that's working on the future? So what did all you did a concrete seal and then do a special? Anybody was around
before you
that.
Put the dirt in.
You remember that because it was so odorous that it emptied out all the restaurants downtown. So we were running door to door apologizing.
So this is the material here that would be going to the city quarry and. This is the material that would be going to Arlington landfill.
Yeah. So the hole is going to be clean, you know, clean concrete. And then this area where they're talking about back further under the structure, where they're taking it down to 12 inches, that's the, if you want to talk about something that might need a cap on it or a floor or something for people to be down there.
Right, but if that were one of the uses for that space.
Yeah. So for example, say you did the first floor development, and you had no need to put anything down there.
Right.
That's one thing. If you go multi-story, you're going to have an elevator shaft. That's not a given. But that doesn't have to go down too far. So then what any contractor is going to do for a water barrier is going to put disc queen down. So that's where the recommendation might be that it be, you know, 12 millimeters instead of 6 millimeter or something like that.
Probably thicker.
Yeah. Or even
We don't want... The reality is people walk in around that area with, you know, heavy construction boots, and we don't want this thing to be torn up, and then you could be exposed. And then maintenance, too, that costs money. So does somebody want to go down there all the time with duct tape? And no, that's not going to make any sense. So we'll have to look at it. Yeah.
So that should be a consideration of what kind of...
What exactly the use is
going to be. Like what Chris was saying, extra money to, if we just didn't go there, then we could just leave it, right? If in the whatever the design that it becomes, if we don't have to go below grade, then
some air conditioning guy's going to go down there to fix a vent. I mean, there's going to be.
If you're putting a big structure on there.
Yeah, yeah.
If it stays a parking lot, then
I'm just talking about a building.
Right.
Yeah. Oh yeah, if it stays a parking lot. Obviously.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
If it stays a parking lot, and we build the, just say you did the original plan. And you filled the hole for the amphitheater. There's no reason to be down there. It'd only be our public works guys occasionally, and they stay on the perimeter chair wall.
So it depends.
And for that whole piece of property, there's no talk of any sort of underground parking or anything like that. The library or anything like that. all off the table, right?
I don't think it's off the table.
I would think that would make sense, just my opinion.
Underground parking? With the water table at 16 inches below?
Still great. Water.
Well, the, keep in mind that the Safeway basement was underground parking. There's a ramp. If you look on that sidewall of the hole, you see that angled marked on it. That's the old ramp that they used to take cars down the road.
And the water table 16 inches below the walkable surface, not the... So there's two different things.
Yeah, yeah.
There's the street surface and then, yeah.
So is that surface basically the same at the same level as the concrete floor of the Safeway?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
Relatively, yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So back to what I said then, there is a possibility at least to have one layer of parking below grade.
Yeah, that's
yeah,
like
still
a,
on the table, yeah.
That's like a question of, that's the other project, the study that they're going to do on potential. Do you want to talk about that, Brian? I mean, I think cost-wise, that's an expensive proposition, but it depends.
Right, but it's something that would be factored into the discussions about if there is development on that site, how do you address and deal with parking?
Right,
because people were talking about parking, and they didn't know if it meant going up or going down, or how far up and how far down. So.
Yeah. And a parking lot that's paved would definitely be considered a cap, a protective cap for DEQ, because you're not going to be able to dig through that come into contact with that material.
Okay.
Yeah, we're good.
Okay.
So everyone is here to be able to talk if they want to have one-on-one questions. Mm-hmm. Rebecca and John and Jeff.
Yeah, we'll be here for a bit. So.
No, thank you all for coming in. And you know, I think it's been a good dialogue, you know, to be able to have both John, our consultant, and also Rebecca from the DEQ kind of to be able to, you know, to talk about the project.